One of the best war photographers in the world, Anya Niedringhaus, was shot and killed in Afghanistan recently. And in the wake of her death, we're thinking about the courage of photographers who risk their lives to cover war, and about the power of the photographs they take. Why do they take them, and why do we look at them? The late Susan Sontag thought about that question for much of her life. Steve Paulson talked with her about one of her last and most famous essays called Regarding the Pain of Others. It's the one in which she asks, does war photography prevent or encourage war?
All war photography is susceptible, available to being used for organizing against war. But I don't think it has to have that impact at all, because I think in certain contexts you see these images as, look at the terrible things the enemy is doing to us. We must fight even harder to repel the enemy. I think to a Palestinian, looking at images of the destruction of the center of the refugee camp in Jenin, these are not anti-war images. These are images which promote militancy.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you point out that many of the classic war photographs over the decades were actually staged. I mean, going back to Matthew Brady during the Civil War, a lot of those pictures of dead bodies were, the bodies were rearranged to make them look especially graphic, I guess you could say. And other classic photos were staged as well. The American soldiers planting the flag at Iwo Jima, that was a recreation of an actual event.
Well, you know, I think that the understanding of photography almost from the beginning was that it was something that was posed. To begin with, it was because exposure time was quite lengthy by our standards. It could be up to 15 seconds in certain light conditions, as long as a minute. So it was understood that photographs were posed. And I think the notion that photographs should be of an absolutely unguarded moment, as if the photographer is a spy catching something, an event or situation or person, unaware of being observed, is a much later notion. You mentioned the iconic World War II photograph of the raising of the flag in Iwo Jima. Now, of course, there was a raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. It happened in the morning. The photographer, who was an army photographer, had people perform the event again, soldiers, later in the afternoon, with a much bigger flag. That's the interesting detail. If you actually look at the flag in that famous picture, it does seem awfully big for soldiers to be carrying around. And, of course, it makes a much handsomer picture.
Does that bother you? I mean, doesn't that seem wrong to do
something
like that?
Oh, I think it bothers everybody. But the standard that a picture should not be tampered with, I think that's been slow in evolving. Now I think people would be extremely intolerant of that kind of thing. But there are two pivotal moments, I think, in the history of war photography. One is the Spanish Civil War, where for the first time a war was covered by photojournalists, most famously Robert Capa, who had cameras that were portable. Before that, photography was basically the camera on a tripod. So the photographer was not going into the thick of battle. But once the portable Leica and film that could shoot 36 images before reloading was developed, you had the photographer going into battle and producing images which really set the standard for what war photography could be. That was, on the whole, very partisan photography. The famous images from the Spanish Civil War are all from photojournalists who were on one side, namely the Republican side. They were against the fascist rebellion led by Franco, which did, in fact, triumph. In the Vietnam War, I think that was a second turning point, where, again, most all of the photography was taken by partisan people who sympathized with the sufferings of the Vietnamese and of the American soldiers, and they were not for the war. And a lesson was learned from the Vietnam War by governments making war that one must not let the photojournalists have free rein.
And you don't see that anymore. I mean, in the first Persian Gulf War, there are very few pictures of actual combat.
Actually, the model for that was in an even earlier war, a small war waged by Prime Minister Thatcher. And when the British Expeditionary Force was dispatched to Argentina to recapture some islands off Argentina that the British owned, Thatcher essentially forbade journalistic coverage or controlled it so thoroughly that virtually no battle scenes or scenes of the carnage and the deaths that were caused in that war.
Now, you mentioned Vietnam, and the ethics get really complicated. And for instance, there's a famous picture, I think it was in 1968, of a South Vietnamese policeman shooting a Viet Cong suspect. And the picture is, I mean, it's unforgettable. It's the moment of death as the bullet is entering the body. But apparently that was, in a sense, staged as well. I mean, that policeman waited for the journalist to assemble before he executed this guy.
That's right. And people often say, well, why doesn't the photographer intervene? You know, photographers are very often accused of being voyeurs, of photographing something when perhaps they could have prevented it from happening. I think that that's a very unfair accusation because in these situations, I don't think the photographer could prevent the event. Maybe I shouldn't say photographers. The public for war photography obviously particularly prizes and finds particularly memorable photographs taken at the moment of death. It's like a whole separate category of war photographs. There's a fabulous example, totally memorable. It's three photographs taken by Tyler Hicks, a marvelous photojournalist who covered the war in Afghanistan in late 2001 for the New York Times. And he shows in three photographs, kind of triptych, the murder of a captured Taliban soldier, a wounded soldier, actually, who's been dragged out of a ditch. He's already wounded, very severely wounded, and is then butchered by advancing Northern Alliance soldiers. And it's absolutely horrible images to look at. Now, what do you feel when you look at that? One's feelings are so complicated, Steve, because I mean, who of us is sympathetic to the Taliban? How can we be sympathetic to the Taliban? It's one of the most atrocious and despotic movements in modern history.
But there is another
side to this. It's
a human being. It's horrible. I don't think anyone can look at those kinds of pictures without feeling horror. But yet, on the other hand, there is a certain thrill. I mean, it's the dirty little secret about what we're talking about. There's a kind of voyeuristic appeal to seeing some of the carnage at times, not always, but at times. It's the reason why, you know, we often slow down as we're driving by a car wreck to try to catch a glimpse of what happened.
It's absolutely true that there is a voyeuristic impulse in many people, in most people, and they will slow down to look at the car wreck and then say, wasn't that terrible? We are attracted in some way to these images. The basis on which we're attracted is rather complicated. Maybe it's that we want to experience that we are safe. You see, if I can go back to the idea of the whole book regarding the pain of others, what does the title mean? It means we are safe, and we are looking at something happening to other people, but we're not there. We're here. We're here looking at a magazine or a newspaper. We're in front of our television sets. We're looking at images on our computer. And the terrible things are happening somewhere else. So why do we want to look at them? First of all, we think we ought to look at them maybe. We have an obligation to look at them, to know what the world is really like. Maybe we have a particular identification with this struggle or a particular interest in it. Maybe we're testing ourselves to see if we really can look at terrible things like a kind of ordeal. But I think in all of these experiences, something is happening, which I think is real at the same time, very questionable, that it's there and it's not here, and if you're just looking at it, you're not responsible.
In a sense, it removes us from the suffering. And I don't want to overplay this, but we can perhaps feel a little more virtuous by going through the pain of looking at these, but yet also in the back of our minds, we know that's not us. I mean, we're safe. We're innocent.
One, it's not happening to us, and two, we're not doing it. Now, the second assertion may be a little questionable. I mean, if your country has gone to war with another country, do you have a responsibility to oppose that war? I think that the images tend to make us feel passive, but I don't think, as I used to think, that they necessarily desensitize us. I think they only desensitize us when we're told this is an age-old conflict, there's absolutely nothing to be done about it, it's hopeless. Then I think you have, you know, say, oh, that again, and you switch the channel. But if you have been told that something can happen, something can be different, if you have another political context, I think these images can be very mobilizing, and I don't think you get used to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I think we tend to feel these days that given the reach of the modern media, that we see everything. We see all the horrors, but that's actually not true. I mean, we don't
see the
worst of it. Going back to the September 11th attacks, we saw repeatedly the plane smashing into the World Trade Center. We saw almost no images of dead bodies. And you know, clearly they were there, but people chose not to show those.
Yes, there was a great deal of largely self-censorship, which of course is the most powerful form of censorship, of the images of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. There are virtually no images of the destruction of the Pentagon and of the people who were killed there. And there were a lot of photographs that were taken, this is well known, of very gruesome things at the World Trade Center. And what was the reason that the people who control the media gave about this? This isn't helpful. Or something you hear very often, this is not in good taste. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm very suspicious when people talk about good taste as a reason for not showing something. It's felt to be unpatriotic. It's felt to be demoralizing. There are all sorts of reasons.
Well, the other reason that's often given is it would be disrespectful to the families of the dead, that somehow it would be dishonoring the memory.
Yes, but that's because Americans have the rather obscene habit of thinking that American lives are worth more than anybody else's lives, and American lives have an entirely different value than other people's lives. We don't have a problem about showing foreign dead. We have a problem showing American dead. Mm.
And it is true that you almost never see the face of a dead American.
Well, those Civil War photographs that were taken by the Brady team on the battlefields of Antietam and Gettysburg did show faces, and they were extremely shocking. They were really breaking a taboo. But by and large, notions of disrespect to survivors is a reason often given that we don't show bad things that happen to Americans. But we have no problem about showing bad things that happen to people abroad, particularly people in Asia or Africa, as if those people didn't have relatives and as if those people couldn't confront those images. I think, again, of the soldier, the Taliban soldier who's butchered in the Tyler Hicks pictures, I don't think it's unlikely that his family saw those images. People are online in Afghanistan. They have access to these images, but we don't think about that. Americans tend not to think about other people being human beings with families in the same way that we think about ourselves.
The late Susan Sontag talking with Steve Paulson about her last book, Regarding the Pain of Others.